Today's show is sponsored by Ting. Please visit dancarlin.ting.com for a $25 service credit or device discount.
A Mr. from the Kalahari Desert writes, "Hey guys, I love the show. One question though. How do you all deal with Dan's intensity level on a day-to-day basis? It must be a grind." "Yes, Mr. I can't pronounce your name. It is. I deal with it by having as little to actually do with Dan as possible. And Ben? The engineer? Ben is just screwed. He's Dan Carlin, and this is Common Sense."
Got a lot to talk about today. You know, they say it never rains, but it pours, and that's how it is with topics. We can go a month or month and a half without any interesting news worth talking about, and then, you know, I take a couple of days out of my schedule to get something done and then, you know, travel somewhere, and then boom, of course, the news hole in the sky opens up and a bunch of interesting things worth talking about or sort of must talk abouts end up falling from the sky right on top of my head and squish me. In this case, let's just start with the house cleaning side of this thing. We had a midterm election since the last program we did. For those of you outside the United States, you know we have a giant election every 4 years, and they choose everything from presidents to senators to congressmen, you know, all the way down to the municipal level and judges and ballot measures and proposals and amendments. And I mean, it's a huge election every 4 years. But halfway between the two huge elections, which are called the general elections, we have something called the midterm elections. Now, they're not as glamorous because there's no presidents vying for the White House. But you have most of the other kinds of things. It'll be senators and governors and congresspeople and all that stuff, you know, in all the little localities running for office. Sometimes the changes that happen because of the midterms can be rather profound. In the election that just happened, the big stakes, as the media made sure you knew, just like a football pregame show, were how well the Republicans were going to do. Public opinion polls had shown that people were suitably not happy, is that a good way to put it, with the direction the country was going, or the leadership of the country at the presidential level, or what have you. And the only choice we have, right, really, in this society is the opposition party. And so people were using the opposition party as sort of a mouthpiece to enunciate their discontent, let's put it that way. And the Republicans were playing that way with their campaigns, right? They were running on the Tar Obama platform, and a lot of Democrats who had done the same opinion polling were running away from any connection to President Obama they had. And as a result, the Republicans did very well indeed, won both houses of Congress, and now control the legislative branch of the government. I would suggest to you that if you are a Republican and you were hoping to win the White House in 2016, that you would have been better off losing the election that just happened. I thought a cartoon that I saw recently, a political cartoon, made that point very clearly. It was a picture of like a grandfather clock with the long pendulum-like arm, I guess, of the clock, hand of the clock. What do you call that? The giant pendulum. There's a proper name, and I'm not thinking of it. But it had that, and it had swung all the way to the left and was hitting President Obama. And on President Obama's chest, it said, "Midterms 2014. But you could see by the arc of the pendulum swing that it was just going to swing back equally far to the other side. And on the other side was an elephant representing the Republican Party, and it said, "Presidential Elections 2016. That's exactly what's going to happen. And it's going to happen because all of a sudden the Republicans now have 2 years to take ownership of all this mess. Whereas for the last 2 years, they've been in a position where they have no power at all. So they can just play the wonderfully, I mean, politicians dream of this role where you can sit back and go, I can criticize everything they do. I have no real power. I can't change it. And I'll portray myself as the defender. You know, I don't have to have proposals of my own. I'm the anti-them. They're the ones who have to stick their necks out and risk something," which is where the Democrats were until the midterm elections just happened. They just flipped the dynamic with the Republicans. Now, don't think, by the way, I mean, you know, part of our problem, I think, sometimes when we think about why things turn out the way they do is we always assume that the A to B motivation, the knee-jerk motivation, the common sense motivation is the one in play. And sometimes it's not. I mean, if your goal is to raise a lot of money to get reelected, playing that defensive position can be very lucrative indeed. There's a lot of people who feel threatened by whatever party's in power, who you can go to and say, listen, you need to donate to my campaign and get me reelected because I'll be the first one who fights, you know, for you. There's, I mean, the great Walter Karp, the late great Walter Karp, I'm rereading some of his stuff now because he wrote some stuff about the First World War. And it's reintroducing me to this very interesting figure. There are a lot of historians and political scientists and whatnot who think like he does. So his viewpoints are not singular, but he sees things in a different light than most people. And he's very good at pointing out that sometimes the motivations of these politicians are not what you think they should be. We think, for example, that the Republicans definitely want to win the 2016 presidential election. Guys like Walter Karp can give you reasons why they might not. The most common being, sometimes you sacrifice one to get enough of the other pieces on the political chessboard. For example, if the presidency represents the most powerful piece on the board, the queen, how many, you know, rooks and bishops would you be willing to win in exchange for that queen? How many congressional positions or senatorial positions or governorships, right? So Karp's pretty good at getting you to look at this differently. If you're looking at it from a Karp point of view, if I'm a Democrat, I wanted the Republicans to win this midterm. Because now they're going to have 2 years to own all these problems, and they will not be able to stand up in the 2016 race and simply say, look what the Democrats did to you, vote for us. Which would have been an option had they lost this midterm and stayed on the outside and could have played the role the Democrats are now going to play for the next 2 years. Just my two cents. But when you look at already what the Republicans are bringing up as issues that they want to fight against and champion, you can see that they're sacrificing. I mean, I would say right now, the stuff Ted Cruz is out there saying publicly, if that sort of thinking is embraced by other Republican presidential wannabes, I think that issue alone would lose an election, considering, you know, the age and technical savvy nature of today's electorate. I mean, you're not campaigning for 70 and 80 year olds anymore. Ted Cruz came out the other day against net neutrality, portraying it as something akin to Obamacare for the internet, and Senator Al Franken on the other side, he's a Democrat, came out and they've been sparring sort of on Twitter and in various other places, and Franken is trying to explain to him that net neutrality is just kind of what we've always had. Nonetheless, if you look at the polls, I mean, Cruz is going to get killed if that's what he actually runs on in 2016, or God forbid he actually manages to derail something that would give you net neutrality or pass something that would take it away. And then you run for president on that will kill you right there. That's a suicidal position with today's electorate. Who knows if he is beholden to people who gave him money to push that issue once he got into power. I don't know that. But if so, he might have been better off again not winning the midterms, his party not winning the midterms, so he could have just sat there and told the people who were giving him money, listen, I'm trying. I'm making the case. I'm doing what I can. I just have no real power. Now he's going to have to put his John Hancock on some bill one way or the other, opposing net neutrality, which like 75% of the public is in favor of. They're doing the same thing, I think, with the attacks that they're going to do. They've been promising to do them. They've been doing them when they were in the minority, so it's nothing but symbolic for years now. They're going to go after the Affordable Care Act. What did they vote, Ben? 40, 50 times when they were in the minority to repeal it? I forgot what the number is. But the point is it's a symbolic vote, and they know it because they don't have the numbers. So no one's going to get upset other than, you know, the Democratic hardcore that you keep voting for this because it doesn't mean anything, but it means something now. So you say to yourself, well, of course they'll vote to repeal now if they did it 40 times or whatever it was when they didn't have the power. Now that they have the power, it's almost incumbent upon them to do that. Yes, but how many people in the general public who vote do you think want them to do it? You know, one of the critiques that conservatives have about new government programs that give benefits to the public is that you don't ever get rid of those things. They become so popular that no one, I mean, you talk about Medicare, taking people's Medicare or taking Social Security. You know what they call those things in the American political system? They call Social Security, for example, the third rail of American politics. You touch it, you die. That's because it's one of those things where the public gets money. And once they get those things, benefits, they don't want to give them up. There may be a lot of stuff that people don't like about the Affordable Care Act, but they know that they like it more than not having anything. There are certainly going to be wealthy contributors to the coffers of Republicans who talk about getting rid of those things. they're just not the majority of people who vote. And by the way, they're even going to be fighting, this is a sure sign, they're even going to be fighting the insurance companies. I read a story the other day that the insurance companies love this ACA, even though they didn't think they would. Their stock price has doubled since it passed. They're making tons of taxpayer money. They're aligning with Obama to keep it the same. I always said if you ever did this healthcare reform thing right, the insurance companies would be the ones most aggrieved and just hate it. So this shows you what I think of the way it went. But still, you know, you go to the voters and you say, we're going to overturn the only healthcare you have in favor of the way it was before. I don't know if that is going to be more unpopular or the net neutrality, but my point is the Republicans seemed a lot better to a lot of people when they could use it as a tool to register their dissatisfaction with the president and Democrats rather than as a tool to actively back the policies of. A Gallup poll taken right after the midterm election showed, I think the number was 44% said that they didn't like the Republicans that they voted for any better than the Democrats or the president, but this is the way you send a message that you're dissatisfied. You don't like the other guys either. Of course, I see that as a positive myself. The beginnings of progress, maybe. Nonetheless, those are my thoughts on the midterms. It's going to be very interesting to see the Republicans now take these policies that most people don't want and try to do something with them and be the majority and enact them and then have to deal with Democratic attacks at the 2016 presidential, you know, race, slamming them for it. I mean, they're going to be, I truly believe that they are probably going to lose the presidential election in 2016 now because they won the midterms the other day. Just my belief. We'll see what happens. It's going to depend a little on the candidates. And oh God, are we going to hate the candidates for both of them? Okay, enough on the midterms. Ben didn't want me to talk about it at all. We've house cleaned. Now, I have two other stories that I feel there's a tenuous connection between. You've heard me do this before, and sometimes I'm imagining this tenuous connection. Sometimes it's actually there. But I've got two stories here. Both are worth discussing. One that occurred since the last show we did, so we would have talked about this anyway. The other, something that I probably owe the people close to it, an apology for not having brought up in depth sooner. Not going to bring it up in depth this time either, so just I'm apologizing for the next time too. But it just crossed another line, and you just have to bring it up again, even in passing. But like I said, I see some relationship between the two. The first one involves a police murderer in Pennsylvania that they captured. Many Americans are probably aware of the story. There was a guy who opened fire on two state police officers, killing one, wounding another, and then fled up into the hills. And the media said he was a survivalist and he was able to elude manhunts and capture for a while. And they finally caught him the other day. The interesting part of this story, because otherwise there's no interest to me about the story otherwise. I mean, I know the media thought it was a great story from a survivalist standpoint, but there was no interest. I mean, it's a police murderer. He's facing a huge list of charges, you know, murder, attempted murder, I mean, like 12 things. And there's no way this guy is not either being executed or serving the rest of his life in prison or like 60 or 70 years. I mean, it's a foregone conclusion. There's no doubt about this guy's guilt at all. What makes this story interesting, though, is that after the police captured this guy, they went through his belongings and his thumb drives and his digital communications and all this and found that his motivation for shooting those police officers was political. And so they've charged him with terrorism, a couple of terrorism charges. Now, they didn't need to do this. As I said, this guy's going nowhere. There's a pretty good chance he's going to the, you know, to the execute, to the gallows, essentially, if you call it that. At best, probably life imprisonment. He's not going anywhere. He doesn't need those terrorism charges. Why are they there? That's when the story becomes more interesting to me because, you know, we've talked to you many times, and you all know about this, that these big laws, and we pass them and have been passing them in this country for more than 200 years, big laws that change a lot of things, are often like seeds, and they get planted, and then they sprout, and then they grow, and then they branch off, and the branches then get branches, and you end up decades later with legal powers and rationales that were never part of the original law when it first came out, that have run far afield of the original intent. Now, this is not a bug. This is a feature in the U.S. system, by the way. This is called the ability to build on precedent and everything. But if precedent wasn't good, then you've just built upon a rotten branch. And that's what something like this terrorism stuff is. Once you throw that word in there when you're talking about this cop killer, you change more than just the cosmetic nature of this. That word terrorism isn't just there to give him a few more years on a sentence that was already going to be endless. It confers a different set of behavioral standards on the whole situation. The reason that terrorism is the key word is because the minute you label something terrorism, you can use the anti-terrorist powers that have been granted to authorities in this country over the last 20 years in that case. And they're much broader. You can do things if something's against terrorism that you can't do if it's not. It's a very good example of why our anti-terrorism laws passed since 9/11 are used overwhelmingly in drug cases, not terrorism cases. The laws are just too darn powerful. If you can start expanding the concept of what a terrorist is, you can begin to expand, you know, to what and to whom you can use these new powers. I believe that the vast majority of people out there who would have supported realistic anti-terrorism, you know, strategies and powers believed in giant terrorist networks like Al-Qaeda being the reason that we needed these things, right? It's the same reason that we passed the anti-racketeering laws. You know, to go after organized crime, which is a specifically hard to target. I mean, they have so much power and money and they're able to elude. We need these special powers to deal with them. And then they're so valuable, those special powers, that some later generation of prosecutors then uses it against something else. And now we use that anti-mafia power from the, you know, late 60s, early 1970s against abortion clinic protesters. Right? That's the branches of the initial seed. The seed is always planted for some extraordinary purpose. Look at how the people who wrote the Patriot Act, people who had 200 years of legislative history that they could examine for examples of that whole dynamic we talked about, of how the seed grows into the branches that you never wanted, and still can come forward today and say they're shocked, just shocked about the way that the government is interpreting their Patriot Act to do those things that Edward Snowden told the public they were doing. That's how it goes, folks. So when you begin to see now the terrorist label, you know, this is a bad guy, and I'll get into his ideas in a minute to show you more, but this is not a person to be admired at all. But it doesn't make it any less of a change when we've now thrown a terrorist label at him. I mean, folks, they throw terrorist labels now at people and WMD charges. I think he got a WMD charge, too, for a homemade bomb. Now, of course, WMD means weapon of mass destruction, and a bomb is a weapon of mass destruction if you want to really think about it that way, because the term lends itself to anything that will kill more than one person. But a gallon of gasoline and a big lighter is a weapon of mass destruction under that category. When people started thinking about special charges you might need to deal with weapons of mass destruction, is that what you were thinking of? Or were you thinking about an airplane being used to smash into a building or a nuclear bomb, you know, to go into a U.S. harbor or some deadly thing like anthrax being spread through the U.S. mail system? Were you thinking that a guy who's just a routine cop killer, who should get what every cop killer, you know, should get, would you think that that's what you would use those powers against? Remember, we have a government that has admitted to torturing people and that being okay because it's terrorism. When you begin to change who the terrorist is, you begin to then have people quickly say, well, this is what we did to terrorists over here. Why can't we do that to terrorists over there? We have environmental activists who set car dealerships on fire at night when there's no one there charged with terrorism. The most interesting part of this story, too, I think when I read the descriptions of what terrorism is, I can't help but think about other examples, including this other story I want to talk about. But let me read you a little of this story just so we've actually covered it, because I'm sure there's a lot of people going, I don't know anything about this story. Can you give me some background? This is from the November 13th, 2014 edition of the Philadelphia Inquirer. The story is written by Ben Finley. From the beginning of the piece, quote, "In the hours after his arrest, Eric Frein allegedly told detectives that he ambushed a state police barracks in the Poconos because he wanted to, quote, wake people up, end quote, about his concerns over the government. The story says, quote, he also described his killing of a state police corporal as a quote-end-quote assassination, according to an updated list of charges filed in court late Thursday afternoon. He shot the corporal, the story says, because, quote, he wanted to make a change, end quote, in government, and believed that, quote, voting was insufficient to do so because there was no one worth voting for, end quote, investigators wrote in the newly filed court records. Friend's alleged claims, the story says, after his arrest resulted in charges of terrorism, a first-degree felony that have been added to a long list of counts that include murder. The Pike County District Attorney has said he will seek the death penalty, end quote. Now, maybe I have my own sensitivities to this story a little bit. The media is portraying this guy as a right-wing terrorist. But listen, I mean, already you heard him say something in his spiel that could have sounded like he was listening to this program. And I'm no terrorist. What else did he say here that said, I mean, from later in the piece, quote, Frein allegedly wrote that, quote, only passing through the crucible of another revolution can get us back to the liberties we once had. I do not pretend to know what that revolution will look like or even if it would be successful, end quote. He said, quote, tension is high at the moment, and the time seems right for a spark to ignite a fire in the hearts of men, end quote, Frein allegedly wrote to his parents. This is the problem, by the way. When you talk about dissatisfaction in government, problems with the political system, no one good to vote for and whatnot, this guy is being portrayed as dangerous because he has those beliefs. But I have those beliefs, too. I don't believe in having a revolution. And I'm not idiotic enough to think that killing anybody, even if I would do something like that, would make a difference at all. I mean, there's no public official at any level of government that you could kill that would do what this guy said he wanted to do, right? No government official you could kill that would spark a revolution. No government official you could kill that would do anything good at all. Certainly no poor family man cop on the beat. Give me a break. So there's brain damage or something involved there, right? To think that one has anything to do with the other. As I said, to me, this is a routine murderer. But why the terrorism charges? Not going to get you any more, you know, time in the clink, right? One of the Philadelphia Inquirer stories, I don't believe it was the same one, said this, which includes some of the definition for terrorism as the law sees it. Quote, Frein appeared by video conference at the hearing with Judge Shannon L. Muir. The terrorism charges are for trying to, quote, influence the policy of a government by intimidation or coercion, end quote, and, quote, affect the conduct of a government, end quote. You see, if you'd have been specific when you wrote the terrorism laws and really made it what most of us thought, well, I didn't think, but I mean, I think most people had this image in their head of what this was all going to be for. If you'd have been specific about what it was all for, I don't think we'd be here today. But because we weren't, any old person can be a terrorist if somebody, you know, can link what they did to views connected with wanting to change government. And, you know, you open yourself up to big questions, and considering some of the attempts at limiting large get-togethers of protesters, I don't think it's too far-fetched to wonder how many protesters out of a large group have to act up before that's considered to be enough violence, you know, to claim some level of terrorism there, because any of these protests are attempts to influence the policy of a government or affect the conduct of a government. So all this stuff becomes quite scary. And again, if you'd have been able to go back in a time machine and tell those people, you know, voting in the wake of the 9/11 attacks, which I've always said is like legislating under insanity. I mean, those people were essentially victims of a traumatic event at that time. If you could show those people and the American public that this is how that legislation that they were putting together and cobbling together was going to end up being employed, I wonder how much that changes the situation. Anybody who's had anything to do with this in terms of actually writing that stuff, they seem to come out and say, this isn't what I intended. And yet, we don't really have anyone doing a very good job of pushing back. Now, the story of Eric Frein, who to me, he's a run-of-the-mill police murderer. The story of Eric Frein is interesting, I think, when contrasted by a situation that I think is thoroughly terroristic, if we're going to start using the word for eco-terrorists and these lone police killers. I mean, if they're all terrorists, well, then certainly I think it's fair to say that what's going on in Mexico is terrorist-inspired violence. I don't think we're treating it like it is. I mean, look at how we treat terrorism, even in small, out-of-the-way countries in the middle of nowhere, when it matches what we want to call terrorism. But what's going on in Mexico, where more than 100,000 people have been killed in just the last few years, to not call that terrorism seems ridiculous. What if you said that Mexico is a terrorist state, and not in the sense that Mexicans want to come over here and hurt us, but in the sense that average Mexicans living in Mexico are simply being run by some version of a collusion sort of relationship between narco-terrorists and government officials. Now, that would be an oversimplification, which is why I haven't talked about this subject up till now. It's not one where I feel like I know the ins and outs, and I don't like to mischaracterize something, but I have been getting emails for years from Mexican nationals saying, why aren't you talking about this? Why aren't you saying that, you know, we can't let our kids out at night to play on the playground because they'll be kidnapped and held for ransom? My inability to understand what it's like day to day from this place to that place, keeps me from trying to overgeneralize, but I do try to stay up on top of the topic. We've mentioned before, sites like borderlandbeat.com, which I think does a great job of helping at least, Northerners, the Americans, understand a little bit better than our own media does what's going on down there. And some of the most horrible pictures and videos I've ever seen in my life, and you know, I've seen a bunch of those things, we're off that Borderland Beat website. Everything ISIS does that appalls us, the drug gangs in Mexico do, and they do it in a more grisly fashion, and they don't fool around. I mean, for all of its horrificness, these ISIS videos have not shown the actual killing process. These rival drug gangs in Mexico, when they make these videos, they'll do it with a chainsaw, and they'll show you the whole process. And first they make the rival gang member say something really abasing, and this is what happens to, you know, people in this gang, and then they'll do these horrible things to them. It's insane. It's insane. And it's meant to send a message. And there's some macho kind of to it, too, and we're the badass, this gang, and people in this gang are going to get this. And there is a tendency in these sorts of situations where you have organized crime members knocking off other organized crime members, where sometimes the general public can just sort of stay out of the way if they can. Sometimes they get caught in the crossfire, but by and large, you know, whether you're talking about Prohibition-era Chicago, where Al Capone is shooting it out with members of Dutch Schultz's gang, maybe, or the O'Banion gang, or whatever, and citizens can say, well, listen, you know, they just kill each other. Isn't that the old line from the mafia? Don't worry, we just kill each other. But in Mexico, it's gone much farther than that. The people that are often paying the price are journalists who expose this kind of stuff, politicians who get elected and are true heroes and want to fight this stuff. They get knocked off. Bloggers get knocked off. And anyone who protests the system is a potential target. Now, this has been going on for years, Dan. Why are you talking about it now? It just took one of those turns that reminds you of what makes this situation different than just a bunch of drug gangs fighting for control of a country and having a lot of money to spread around and whatnot, because the government, at least at certain levels, is involved in this too. And this is something I'm sure the Mexicans understand much better than I do. This story's horrible, but again, not that unusual. I'm going to go over it, sort of gloss over it. I'm sure I'm missing a lot of nuance, but the basis of the story is that a bunch of nursing students at a college showed up to protest in a town, I hope I get the pronunciation right, in the southwest of Mexico called Iguala. And the mayor of Iguala, and he has a wife who's aspiring to public office too, had planned a speaking engagement for her. She was going to speak to the public, and these protests were going to potentially disrupt that. This is the narrative, by the way. We're going to say alleged now, because all this is alleged to have happened. Allegedly, the mayor of this town was so angered by the protests and the fact that they might screw up his wife's speech, and he already wasn't happy with them, and that some violence broke out between the police and the protesters. It sounds like the protesters ran and the police shot at them. It doesn't sound like it was much of a two-way street. And then allegedly, the mayor told the police to arrest a bunch of these people, at least 43 of whom were taken by the police to narco-terrorists, and then told by the police that the college students were in fact narco-terrorists from a rival drug gang, and then had them kill them, burn them, chop them up, dump them in the river. 43 of them. Now, no one knew this at the time. All that Mexico knew was that these 43 had been taken away by local police and were not seen again, and no one knew where they were. So protests erupted. They quickly, you know, engulfed some of these places in some violence and some burning and all these sorts of things that supposedly made the protesters look bad. But how would any of us feel? I mean, take any American community you want to grab and say 43 of your college age kids were shuffled off into police cars and we haven't seen them since. How many days would we put up with that, right? Now, as I said, to make matters worse, allegedly the person who ordered this was the mayor of the town. Okay, so you have a government official in collusion with the narco terrorists to punish people protesting, you know, policies of the government. So you think to yourself, okay, well, these drug gangs are spreading a lot of money around. Of course, there's going to be corruption. Al Capone bought off politicians, too, back in the Prohibition, roaring 20s, you know, corrupt era of Chicago, didn't he? Yeah. How high does that corruption go, though? Does it stop with the mayor of Iguala, or does it go higher than that? Well, you don't ever know. It's not like they wear a special badge, although I imagine Mexicans could say he's a crusader trying to stop these problems, because you see those, by the way. The military raids these people. They capture some of these drug lords. It is happening. But I imagine Mexican nationals could point to another one and go, he's corrupt as hell. He's working with the narco terrorists. I don't know. All I know is that the portrayal of tiredness on the part of Mexico's attorney general the other day, again, sort of what puts this story over the top, was particularly ill-timed. This is from a Associated Press piece by Maria Verza from Sunday, November 9th, 2014. Imagine if this same thing happened to the United States, 43 students kidnapped by the local police, not seen again. Then you find out the local power structure of a particular town ordered them murdered. They took them to criminals who murdered them. And now the attorney general holds a press conference about this and then does this. Dateline Mexico City from the beginning of the piece, quote, an off-the-cuff comment by the attorney general to cut a news conference about the apparent killing of 43 missing college students has been taken up by protesters as a rallying cry against Mexico's corruption and drug trade-fueled violence. During the session, the story says, that was televised live Friday, Attorney General, I hope I pronounced this right, Jesus Murillo Caram, announced that two suspects had led authorities to trash bags believed to contain the incinerated remains of the slain students, who haven't been seen since being led away by police in the southwestern town of Iguala on September 26th. After an hour of speaking, the story says, Murillo Caram, the Attorney General, abruptly signaled for an end to the questions by turning away from reporters and saying, in English the phrase is, enough, I'm tired, end quote. Within hours, the story says, the phrase became a hashtag, linking messages on Twitter and other social networks, end quote. He said later on he hadn't slept very much and he was tired, but doesn't that make it look like the government really doesn't care so much that 43 of your children were taken into government police cars and never seen again? You know, given Mexico's long, contentious history with the United States, it's hard to say that the U.S. should do anything more than it's doing to help Mexico. And we are doing some things. We give them some money to fight, you know, the drug scourge, and we send in some helicopters sometimes, and we'll throw in some SEALs here and there. I mean, we're doing some stuff. But if you compare it to our reactions to, in air quotes, terrorism in other countries around the world, it's remarkable how little we're doing. I think it's very possible that we're afraid of the same thing in Mexico we've been afraid of in Mexico for a very long time, and that's that the government of Mexico might somehow be overthrown or replaced by a government of Mexico that was not as subservient as the governments of Mexico traditionally are, and that cared more about your average Mexican citizen than, well, the interests of this or that rich. Well, I mean, it sounds a little like us until you get to the narco-terrorist part, but the rich folks in the oligarchy of Mexico. I think if the people in Mexico rose up against their current government, the United States might come in then and knock the new government out of power and replace it with something a little bit more traditional. It does kind of make you wonder, that line that the Pennsylvania guy, you know, the reason that terrorism was brought up against him is because the legal definition includes the phrase, quote, to influence the policy of a government by intimidation or coercion. And the other one is, quote, affect the conduct of a government, end quote, by using methods that might be construed as violent, for example. I wonder how long Americans would have to live in the shoes of the Mexicans under what they're living under now before we thought that those things that are prohibited by the U.S. terrorism laws were exactly what was justified in the current climate. Just curious. You know, that old line about one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter. You do look at the situation in Mexico and say, when they're taking people who are marching against the policies of the government away and killing them, it's worth asking, one, how far up and high the food chain that goes, mayor of Iguala or higher. And next, it's worth suggesting that the people in that country are captive. I don't know what the world can do about that, but you know me, the first step in deciding something clearly is defining it clearly. Be interesting to hear what Mexican folks have to say about my characterization of it as I see it. This next story probably seems a little self-serving, but it hits close to home, and not just with me. I would imagine with a lot of you out there, more and more people are creating content in the world today. And you know what that means, right? Any kind of art or YouTube video or podcast or blog. I mean, content is anything sort of devoured by the public or members of the public. And more people are doing this all the time. I mean, this has got to be the greatest jump in content creation in global history, right? With the rise of the internet and things like podcasting and blogs and all these things. It's removed one of the traditionally very powerful, lucrative positions in the entertainment world. And I've spoken to you folks about this many times, that the role of the gatekeeper or the middleman or the choke point in the media relationship that's existed since time immemorial. I mean, you go back to ancient Greece and your name is Aristophanes and you write plays. You're going to have to deal with the guy who owns the amphitheater and owns that stage at some point, who's going to say, yeah, Aristophanes, I'll give it a listen. If I like it, I'll let you show it on my stage. If I don't like it, I won't. That's one power right there. The second power is to say, yeah, you know, I like your work, Aristophanes, but I don't like what you wrote about Sophocles in it. He's a friend of mine. Take that line out, or I won't let you show your work to the public. And then the final thing that the middleman gatekeeper role would say, which is part of why it's so powerful and lucrative, is, yeah, Aristophanes, I like your work. I'm going to let you show it to the public for 50% of the gate receipts, right? So you make money off the deal. You have power. You have censorship power. You can censor on the broad level by not letting the work be shown, censor on the specific level by making them take something out or do something differently. And then if it is good and the public does like it, you get to have a piece of it. Shouldn't be any surprise that there were people who wanted to see that role perpetuated, and there is, in my opinion, people who want to see it recreated. The internet, though, has destroyed the gatekeeper, the traditional relationship that existed not just with people who owned the amphitheater and the stage for playwrights, but controlled the publishers for books or newspapers, the people who owned the radio transmitters of radio stations, the people that owned television broadcast outlets, the people who made movies and were directors and did the casting. People who got to decide if they liked your work before you got to show it to the public to see if the public liked your work. For the time being, that middleman position is gone or irrelevant. I mean, if you want to get into TV, you're still going to have to deal with those people. But the modern distribution system that is the internet has made that not necessary anymore. Once upon a time, you had to be discovered to get a chance to do your content creation. Now you don't. You can just do your stuff, throw it out there, and if it's good, people will discover it, make it viral, share it, and all those kinds of things. That's a wonderful, unbelievable change in the state of things if you're a content creator. Now, the downside, though, is that while it's easier to be discovered and to show your work to others, once you find you have an audience, it's tougher to get paid for what you do, especially if your standards are as high as the kind of money that people like Taylor Swift is making. Taylor Swift, the singing artist, has pulled her music off a popular sort of an internet radio streaming service, claiming that the art is not being valued highly enough in financial terms, and that the art is valuable and creative expression is valuable, deserves to be paid for, and the right amount. And the way she's couching this argument, she's couching it as though she's doing this not just for herself, but for all content creators out there. She's taking a stand sort of for the value of art, that it should not be pirated, it should not be shared, it should not be free. There should be a system to extract value from the person who enjoys the content. and her move has been followed by several other less notable performers. Now, what Taylor Swift and others who've said this are hampered by is the fact that they're enormously successful right now. So Joe Rogan, I think, on a recent show had the lead singer from the rock band Kiss, and he's made millions, but I think several times in Joe's show, he got on the soapbox about, you know, how much piracy's ripping them off. It's so hard to feel sorry for those people, isn't it? They're bad spokesmen or spokespeople, in a sense, for the poor, undercompensated content creator. Nonetheless, I think they have a good point. But what do you do about it? Well, here's the way I view it, because you know me, I'm a pessimist. I would worry more about whatever system you put into place to defend the right of the artist to be compensated. I mean, I think the best way to do that would be to set up the gatekeeper idea again, and I'm so totally against that. I like the Radiohead idea, and I've mentioned this to you before, where they put out a song and sort of said to the public, okay, download the song for free, pay us what you think it's worth afterwards. And then they got, I think famously, more than they would have gotten from the public doing it that way than they would have if they'd gone the traditional distribution route and done it through the record company. And this was purported to be the beginning of a new business model, showing that this is how anybody can do it. But was it that, or was it a novelty? Is that sustainable? And that's what none of us knows. Also, does it have a diminishing returns aspect in inverse proportion to how well the artist is doing, right? So if Taylor Swift started today on the internet and everybody was supporting her because she's great and she does this great job and we want to keep hearing music from her, but then all of a sudden millions and millions and millions of people are supporting her and you start thinking to yourself, Taylor Swift doesn't need this money as much as I do. To heck with that. She's got millions and millions of fans. So does success kill the ability to continue to make a living doing the art once you're perceived as being, well, where Taylor Swift is, for example? When I talk to people about this all the time, you know, we discuss our business practices, which most of you are fully aware of. The initial shows are for free. The initial Common Sense shows and Hardcore History shows are for free, and they stay free for, well, right now, like a couple of years. I mean, the history shows don't go into the paid archive for a couple of years. And then when we charge you for them, our attitude was always that we realized who our biggest competitor is. Our biggest competitor is free. It's piracy, right? And rather than try to figure out some, I mean, beyond me anyway, of stopping people from pirating, we figured we would just lower the price to something that was so ludicrously low for the amount of, you know, content you were getting that it would just seem like it'd be easier to pay us that amount than to pirate it, and certainly easier on your conscience, maybe. I mean, you know, $1.99 or whatever we charge for hours of history show, compare that to a song, and we figured, listen, we're still going to get pirated, but that'll help. I think that's something maybe a Taylor Swift or someone like them would say is a perfect example of how we're undercutting our own value. Those shows could be $10 shows, $12 shows. But at the same time, if I hadn't had this open, free, virally shared internet, would I even be here? If I had to convince Hal, the amphitheater stage owner in ancient Greece, to let me show you my podcasts before I got to make any money off them or decide if, you know, you'd like them, would Hal let you see them? I think Taylor Swift was going to be successful in any model. So a person like that pines away for the 1970s again, for example, when artists, after they've been around for a while, let's not forget the middlemen often took them to the cleaners as the price of long-term fame. So it was not unheard of to have a band who had two albums out and owed the record company money. But a Taylor Swift is going to do well under that old model. I don't think I would have been picked up and shown to you under the old model. So it's hard for me to complain. Do I worry about sustainability? Will this job be here in 5 years? You know, is this model that we're using viable over the long haul? I have no idea, but what choice do I have? The only thing that makes me feel better is we're all in the same boat, whether you're a content creator like I am, and I know many of you are, or whether you're just Joe Blow who goes to the factory and sews things on an assembly line for a living. We are all, you know, what's the one day away from unemployment one way or another. Why should I be any different than you? Is this a good time for my clarification, Ben? I wanted to clarify something from two shows ago, and I'm going to take a rare position here because normally when I clarify any communications misunderstanding on this program, it's my fault. That's how I see it. If you're going to be the communicator. You have to communicate clearly. I listened to what I said, though, on the show 2 shows ago. I think it's 2 shows ago, Ben, the one we did about teaching history. And I said it just the way I wanted to say it. So some of you maybe heard something that wasn't there, or maybe it just requires a little clarification. So let me give you some, and we'll move on. Ben actually said, don't even talk about it. Don't open that can of worms. But I thought, you know, I don't like being misunderstood. I don't like people thinking something about me that's not true. And we had talked about, it was a throwaway line, because we were talking about history and education and teaching it in schools and all that. And I mentioned creation science for a minute. Not creationism, creation science. And I said it was bunk, right? And a lot of people were angry about that. But there were 2 kinds of angry. The kind that knew that creation science was invented and had an ulterior motive, sort of, but didn't care because they thought that the lessons imparted were so valuable it outweighed, you know, what you were losing. So instead of teaching whatever mainstream science thinks is right, teach this biblical narrative because society incurs subsidiary benefits, right? Some of these people we're talking about are more moral people, someone who believes in something greater than themselves, those kind of things. So understood that maybe it doesn't all work, but, you know, we were a better country when we taught those kind of things. And then there were the people that assumed that when I said creation science, I meant creationism. The difference is this. Creationism, in a broad sense, means that our reality here was, at least at the very beginning, connected to some sort of deity, right? It's the difference between being religious and not being religious, I guess, in the very most basic sense. Now, it's my opinion, shall we say it that way, because this is a religious question. It's my opinion that there's nothing that science unveils about how the physical world works that means there can't be some sort of deity involved. I said it before, you know, my aunts were Carmelite nuns, and I would have these discussions with them, and they would just proclaim the things that science was finding as the divine mechanism in action, as they called it, right? So what science is showing you is how God works, if you believe in a God-centered reality. I think that that is a completely viable belief, right? And people make assumptions about me, like I got a lot of, you know, you damned atheist letters, but I'm not an atheist. I simply can't understand how, and this is just me, but how a human being can be expected easily to be so sure about any sort of reality out there. I'm open to everything, and I listen to everything, and I have no problems with anyone if they're not sacrificing children on the altar. I mean, I do have some standards, but basically, I have no problem with anyone, religious or atheist, belief. So, for me, creationism is not some discredited idea. I wouldn't teach it in the science classroom. I'm also, just for those of you who think about this, I'm in favor of letting you pick your schools. I mean, if you're going to pay taxes for an education that's mandatory, I'd let you send your kids where you want to go. And if you think that some sort of God-centered science class is what you want your kid to learn, to me, in an America based on freedom, you should have the right to do that. And it shouldn't just be for people who can afford private schools. So to me, that's how I solve that problem. But let me clarify. When I say creation science, which is what I said in that program, that's not the Bible, folks. That was something created in the early 1960s, mind you, as a way to get around court decisions that said you could no longer teach the biblical version of creation in public schools. What do you do when that happens, right? You turn around and you try to make the biblical story of creation scientific enough so that it meets the requirements so you can still do that. 2 guys wrote a book in the early 1960s, and that's the beginning of the modern creation science movement, right? And if it were real, you would have a lot of scientists who were not Christian who were doing it. I mean, as I said to many people who wrote in that said that this should be taught in science classrooms around the country, I said, so if creation science scientists find something in their research that doesn't mesh with the Bible story that they're purporting is true, what do they do with that evidence? And if they don't change the whole theory to fit the evidence, that's not science. And I got quite a few letters from Christians who thought I was going after their religion when I said creation science is bunk. But folks, a lot of the things purported to be part of creation science have nothing to do with the Bible at all. I mean, this idea, for example, and it's got to be the number one thing that conflicts with what science is telling us, this idea that the earth is 6,000 years old, right? That is something, I'm sorry, folks, I mean, that's just not true. You can bury your head about the evidence, but it isn't. It might not be what the scientists say it is, but it's not 6,000. All right. And if you want to teach that in religion class, I'll send you to a religious school. You can use your tax dollars, and you can have your kid learn that. That's fine with me. But that's not science. Now, that's not in the Bible either. Bible never says the world is 6,000 years old. Some guys in the 17th century trying to, you know, figure out, okay, if a lifetime is this long and there's this many kings in the Bible. I mean, they came up with that number, right? So when somebody slams a viewpoint that's not in the Bible as though they somehow contradicted the Bible, although there's places to contradict the Bible too, you know, that's a different story than what some of you were portraying. So not so much apologizing for saying that creation science should be taught in school, but pointing out that that's a very different thing than creationism, and it also is not something that takes a stand one way or the other on whether or not this universe is some sort of random occurrence out there or some sort of deity-based reality, okay? So let's just understand that. So when I said creation science, it was a very specific term. That ought to be enough of an apology or explanation to get me in plenty of more trouble, right? In any case, like I said, for me, I'm one of those guys that think we would solve so many of our problems on these kind of issues by allowing parents to choose whatever school they want for their kid, take the tax dollars as though it's some sort of grant that they would pay into a school system, and apply it wherever they want. Then we get out of this. You teach your kid what you want him to learn. I'll teach my kid what I want him to learn. And if they can't get a job as a biologist later, maybe the free market works that thing out or something. Nonetheless, maybe they go into a different field. You know, as I talk about a subject like this, I'm just reminded that it's probably been too long since we've talked about public schools and the challenges that really a more than 100-year-old design in the United States faces in trying to adapt to the 21st century world. I mean, the school system in this country is based on a design for an America that was much less diverse than the United States is now. An America where local school boards had a lot more power to craft the feel and reality of the schools to kind of adhere better to local conditions. I mean, you know, once upon a time, a school board in a place like Eastern Tennessee could really create a classroom environment that reflected the values of Eastern Tennessee. And a school board, a local school board in Oregon, could do the same thing for local conditions in Oregon. And the Oregon schools might be quite a bit different than the Eastern Tennessee schools. And that was okay. But with standardization, you know, the hot button issue now is Common Core, No Child Left Behind, all these federalization policies designed to increase excellence in education and standards and testability that is applicable across the board, all that stuff just diminishes even more the local variations, which help to act as a safety valve to keep people from feeling like their schools were teaching subjects and approaches and viewpoints that contradict what's being taught at home. I have people who work in the public school system, some of whom will suggest that that is part of what the public school's job is to deprogram, de-brainwash people that are being taught incorrect things at home. But I don't agree with that. I think the taxpayers are the boss. And if you happen to be a taxpayer that's rich or who has a lot of disposable income, you have the ability to opt out of this system. You'll send your kid to a private school that teaches whatever the heck you want them to learn, and that's fine. The people that have no choice are the people that don't make that much money. Is it fair to say that, you know, only poor people should have to send their kids to schools that undercut the values they teach at home? It doesn't seem right to me. So maybe a topic for a different day, but it's a much bigger issue, suffice it to say, than just biblical teachings and parents and creation science. This crosses the political spectrum and a lot of times crosses national spectrums, too, where you have recent immigrants and all kinds of other people who want their kids to learn values that reflect, you know, maybe even values from a different country. Should they have the right to do that? That's a theme for another show. My hope is that we didn't cut to the chase too much on all these different issues today, and my apologies if we did. It's a known problem with shows where we address multiple issues in a single episode. Sometimes I don't give enough foundational information, at least in my own mind, before we dive right into the topic and start talking about it. So hopefully we did on today's topics. And if we didn't, my apologies. And I will blame it on the fact that my brain is thoroughly ensconced in the time period somewhere between 1914 and 1918 right now, as I sit here and wrestle with my nemesis, which is December and January. It's always been a hard period for the Hardcore History Show, and I'm wrestling with it now, and my goal is to get this darn show out before the new year, and if we can do that, we will have roughly matched our output in hours anyway, in the history show from what we put together the last few years. So that's my goal. And as I said, my apologies if my brain seems a little stuck in the past, but of course there's a logical explanation for that. Thank you for your indulgence, everybody. Until the next time. We've told you about Ting on this program before. Ting is a mobile service. You sign up using the Sprint Nationwide network. You buy a phone. You get it in 2 to 5 business days. You activate it. You know, you can select a new phone number or port an existing one. And then you begin to use the service that doesn't charge you for service you don't use. Basically, Ting is exploiting a market hole where cell phone providers and service providers have been using all sorts of restrictions to keep you in their cell phone plans, whether or not you want to be. Ting starts by not doing that. It's a service where, you know, you don't have a long-term contract. If you don't like it, you get rid of it. You only pay for what you use. Ting breaks down your rates by minutes, text messages, and megabytes, and then they bill you at the end of the month for what you use. Sounds like a pretty good deal to me. Sort of sounds like the deal you should have had all along, right? Well, Ting is one of the entities out there that's kind of pushing the old line cell phone industry to adapt to a more user-friendly approach. But why would you use the people that are being forced into this as opposed to the people that are leading the way? How is Ting different? Well, we already told you, no contracts. But how about no bundling or ride-along services either? No overage charges or penalties, no add-on charges, no mysterious line items on your bill, unlimited devices on one plan, a control panel that helps you work out what you're spending and what you're using and what you want, and how about no-hold customer support if you've got a problem? You know, when you can leave a company at any time, they tend to treat you with a little bit more concern than if you're locked into some long-term deal and you really don't have any choice. And isn't that the way the consumer and company relationship ought to be structured? Go to dancarlin.ting.com and you can save $25 off your first Ting device when you sign up.
If you think the show you just heard was worth a dollar, then cough it up. Nonpartisanism doesn't attract the big donors, you know. And hey, you Europeans and Pacific Rim people, yeah, I'm looking at you, Australia. You people are just as susceptible to guilt as everyone else. So put a little shrimp on the barbie for Dan and Ben, because we know where you live. In Australia.
Do you shop online at Amazon.com? If you do, consider doing so through the Amazon search window on DanCarlin.com. Your shopping experience will be the same as always, but Amazon will give Dan and Ben a little kickback for sending you there.
Thanks again for all your Buck-a-Show donations. They're the reason we're still here.